You know, most of us sense that the human species hurtling towards some kind of event. Images of the apocalypse, extinction, metamorphosis, they haunt us. But most efforts to look through those dark glasses of the future and see what's up ahead have been, well, dismal failures. Up next, Jonathan Zapp joins us. His work, Crossing the Event Horizon, Human Metamorphosis, and the Singularity Archetype, next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. Jonathan Zapp is an author, philosopher, journalist, and teacher who has written extensively on psychology and contemporary mythology. He's the author of The Zapp Oracle and is a featured correspondent, editor for Reality Sandwich, which is a very popular online magazine. Jonathan has extensive background in Jungian psychology, paranormal research, and dream interpretation as well. Jonathan, welcome back to Coast. I'm looking forward to this tonight.
Me too. It's great to be back, George.
You know, we're talking about the archetypes, and as you have gotten into this with your Crossing the Event Horizon, explain what that means for so many people. Singularity archetype. What is that?
Okay. Well, good question. And I'll start with just the last part of that phrase, archetype. What is an archetype? Because this is an idea that goes back to Plato, but the great Swiss psychologist and psychiatrist Carl Jung really developed it and helped us to really understand that it is something that is cross-cultural, cross-period, and really demonstrates that there is a collective unconscious, that human minds are not born as blank slates, but that there are these sort of primordial images, they're sometimes called, that shape our minds and our psyches and our personalities. And examples include the hero, the great mother, the trickster, the shadow. And so, for example, one of the most familiar is the hero archetype, and that turns up in every culture along with the whole cycle. So, for example, Moses goes through it. So does Buddha, so does Odysseus, but so does Luke Skywalker and Neo in The Matrix. And so the hero archetype, and archetypes are really like living agencies. They mediate whole phases of our lives and whole parts of our personalities. So it isn't just these mythic characters that go through the hero cycle, but there's probably a kid down the street who's just started a new school or entered the military or gone on some adventure, and he's probably going through his version of the hero cycle. And if any of us who's old enough looks back on some phase of our life, we can see that we went through a phase where there'll be a call to adventure, some new challenge beckons, there'll be some helpful figures that'll come along, there'll be other figures we call threshold guardians that may try and stop you or tell you're going to fail, and you have to kind of push past that threshold. You may have a descent into darkness. Then you like learn some new secrets and you bring them back to the greater world and so forth. And so you see that pattern show up all these different places. Joseph Campbell wrote a book called A Hero with 1,000 Faces. It really could have been called A Hero with 1,000,000,000 Faces. And so this is what the way an archetype is universal and will have a powerful effect on our lives, even if we don't understand it. Now, the singularity archetype is one that I discovered in 1978 when I was 20 years old. And there's sort of a co-discoverer whose name is Dr. Michael Grosso. He's a philosopher associated with several universities, mm-hmm. and he started writing about it in the 80s. But we both saw the same basic aspects to it. He calls it the archetype of death enlightenment, but we both related it to parapsychology, ufology, near-death experience, and all these various things. Where the archetype relates to two great event horizons in people's lives. And one is the personal event horizon of death, and the other is eschaton, or the end point, or a point of quantum evolutionary change for the species. And so the life cycle of the individual and the life cycle of a species, sort of like a fractal or a hologram where the small part recapitulates the whole, they parallel a bit. Both the personal lifespan and the lifespan of a species are a certain amount of linear time. For us, maybe it's between 0 and 100 years. For the species, the average lifespan of a species is 100,000 years, and for mammalian species, it's 1,000,000 years. Of course, our species is working to lower the average, but still, Even under the best of circumstances, any species is only going to last so long before it becomes extinct or it undergoes some quantum transformation.
That's a given, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's something that absolutely has to happen, just like personal death has to happen. And so the singularity archetype gives us information about those two parallel event horizons of the quantum evolutionary change for the species that's already underway and that we're hurtling toward, and also the other event horizon that's guaranteed for each of us, which is death, which is not a depressing thing for me, but I see it as an exciting portal of transcendence. And in near-death experience, we see the person will actually go through the transformations that the singularity archetype predicts for the species. So it actually gets experienced. It's not just something, an image of a future prophecy, though it does give us ideas about where we're heading toward in the future. It is also something that people are experiencing right now and being changed by right now. And it can happen in any of a number of circumstances where people have a crossing the event horizon-like experience. So that is the most dramatic example is a near-death experience, but sometimes it can be when people take psychotropic drugs. It can be when people have what seems to be an abduction experience, whether it really is or not. They may go through many of the classic phases, an out-of-body experience. And I'm not the first person to notice this parallelism between the near-death experience, the UFO experience, the psychedelic experience. Other people that have noticed it include Dr. Kenneth Ring, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the University of Connecticut, who's one of our greatest researchers in near-death experience, and he wrote a couple of books in the 80s called Heading Toward Omega and the Omega Project, where he showed the correlation between these. Terence McKenna often talked about them. And so the fact that there's this pattern that people go through, you know that the stages of a near-death experience seem to be universal and happen to people in all different parts of the world at different times, and it suggests an archetype. It suggests that there's this underlying pattern that is there and is mediating this event horizon experience.
They're experimenting right now with veterans who have PTSD, and they think they can put chips in their head, Jonathan, and eradicate that with this high technology. Will we ever get to the point where the human brain will be that manipulated, that wired, for all kinds of things?
Well, this is a real question, and it turns up in some of the manifestations of the singularity archetype, which can appear in people's dreams, but also as science fiction fantasies is a particularly fertile place for it, like in the movie 2001. There are competing streams of evolution, and this is a theme that we can develop as the evening goes on, even related to psychopaths. There are different evolutionary streams that are working together and sometimes working cooperatively, sometimes antagonistically, and we some part of the future may be unformed, and we don't know which will prevail or predominate. So we have artificial intelligence, and we have technology. The evolution of technology is exploding. And then we also have changes in human consciousness that is changing largely because of technology. So even without having chips in our brains have been massively rewired than the brains of our fathers and grandfathers. Because you and I, George, as baby boomers, we've grown up in an image-saturated world with television and movies and so forth. And
kids
growing up today, it's even far more because they may have virtual reality games that they can play. They have the internet. They have visual technologies that are rewiring the brain. So we are being changed by technology, and that change is going to exponentiate because we will be able to manipulate the brain. And we also may have AI as a competing stream of evolution. And so basically, the singularity archetype, or many visions of it, show this boiling cauldron of powerful variables and evolutionary forces, which may play out in many different ways.
Is it a good thing or a bad thing, the singularity archetype?
Well, with any archetype has a light and a dark side. Okay, so in other words, even the hero. And so the singularity archetype on the positive side holds the secrets and provides us with a kind of portal of transformation and metamorphosis. On the other hand, people easily become possessed by archetypes and become deranged. So for example, a group that was possessed by the singularity archetype with some unfortunate consequences is the Heaven's Gate suicide cult.
Right.
That was obsessed with metamorphosis. They called themselves, you know, in a form beyond human. They wanted to have this metamorphosis. They thought that there was a mothership waiting for them on the other side of the Hale-Bopp comet. And we know how it ended with a suicide of 39 people who thought they were going to leave their bodies and cross the event horizon.
Yep.
Into this mothership.
Right.
So that's an example of how the archetype that could be very, you know, positive and give people a pathway to metamorphosis can also drive other people crazy. And that's true for any archetype.
Now, the archetypes, are they images? Are they events? Are they people? Or all of the above?
Well, in a sense, they're all of the above, but and it's very hard to describe what they are because they're also inside of us and shaping us. But they are called living agencies. They are subjects, not merely objects, in the same sense that we are subjects. They can be said to have intentions. So, in other words, a young male comes along and somebody tells him about a great opportunity. He may not know anything about the hero archetype, but that is sort of a channel that's already been carved into the topography of the human psyche before he ever got there. And so as he directs himself toward that call to adventure, he is likely to go through those same kind of passages that other people have gone with the hero cycle. So it's sort of a primordial image and template, but also active agency that will mediate for us. And when we engage it, it will kind of take us through a series of transformative steps and also may at times define our personality in various ways.
What is the upside? What's the best thing people can expect with this?
Well, the best thing that people can expect with it, one of the ways of seeing it in a more, you know, we can talk about how it might affect the whole species, and it is already affecting the species in lots of ways, but some of the best aspects of it can be seen in the positive near-death experiences, where people who have a near-death experience and are really having an encounter with the singularity archetype, where many of the different aspects of it, like a telepathic network, a visual telepathy, a transformed ego, they experience these things in the near-death experience. So when they come back, they are transformed. And in fact, when they've been studied 7 years after in the best prospective studies of near-death experiencers by Dr. Pim van Lommel, a Dutch cardiologist, I think he maybe have even had him on the show at some point.
Yeah.
People were even more changed, or the changes had even built up momentum 7 years out. And so these people become more loving. They become more spiritual. Their church attendance will go down. However, their reported spirituality will go up. And in the control group of people that Dr. Lommel studied that had cardiac arrest but no NDE, you would see none of these changes. Their church attendance went up, but their reported spirituality went down somewhat, and they didn't have any of these kind of transformative effects that the people who had the near-death experiences did. And so those are ways in which it can transform the individual who has an encounter with the singularity archetype, and the species can also be greatly transformed. And it may be being transformed right now, because the technological evolution that has made everything so much more visual has shifted the hemispheric dominance in the brain from the left, which is more alphanumeric and linear and hierarchical, to the right. And this may be the reason why, as much as the news headlines wouldn't have you think this, that we have the least violence and the lowest per capita war death rate happening now on the planet than we have probably had in 6,000 years.
Jonathan, back in 1953, an author by the name of Theodore Sturgeon wrote a book called More Than Human, where he hypothesized that there would be a different breed of human out there. Does that fit into this archetype?
Absolutely. And in fact, it was Ted Sturgeon who coined a term that I've adopted, Homo Gestalt, because basically in his novel, and later I'll give you some other examples of the singularity archetype to help ground this, because we've kind of talked about it in the abstract and people might want some examples. But More Than Human is a classic sci-fi novel that is an example. And you have a group of mutants who feel isolated, but they have special powers. Each of them is very different. And when they come together, they form almost like a family. They form something that Theodore Sturgeon called Homo Gestalt. They form a telepathic network, and they retain their individuality, though. And the sum of the whole is greater than the parts. They become basically a new species. And so this is one of the key aspects of the singularity archetype, is that people... there's a change in both consciousness and communication, where instead of the little mouth noises like we're making right now, people have this rich visual telepathic communication exchange with others, and that also happens when people have near-death experiences, and their consciousness changes. Without losing their individuality, they become much more aware of other people and also of the living world around them. And this is a crucial transformation, because something that has put a sort of Damocles over the species is that we now have such lethal technologies, and technologies that even a single individual pressing the wrong button or releasing the wrong germ or something could have devastating results. With that lethal technology and our present egocentric consciousness, where people can look out for number one and can look at the world as real estate and livestock, the world is a chessboard, these are a lot of the people that run the world, mm-hmm. Those two together are a path toward extinction. And so having that sort of Damocles over our head, where the egocentric individual consciousness, the opposite of Homo Gestalt, because that's unworkable, it creates the pressure for the species to have some kind of a breakthrough into this other form of consciousness that would allow us to harmonize and synergize and cooperate in a much more profound way. And a friend of mine, Johnny Haberlin, who's an evolutionary biologist, has been giving me some great ideas about how this happens in nature and how it happens.
In nature, it's done naturally. Literally, automatically, isn't it? It forms that way.
Yeah, many systems in nature work with stunning harmony and cooperation. And an example is our bodies. You know, our bodies are a network of 60 trillion cells, each one of which has a complexity of a small city, and yet this whole incredible. You know, the population of the Earth is only 7 billion, but we have 60 trillion organisms harmonizing and working together. So I'm very much an optimist, and the singularity archetype shows us one of the key aspects of it is that what looks dark and what looks apocalyptic from the point of view of the ego, when viewed from a cosmic vantage, and I'll give examples that will show what this looks like in
all right, we'll take this minute for a second, John, because we're going to come right back. We hit this break in just a moment. Jonathan Zapp with us, Crossing the Event Horizon, and his website, of course, is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Jonathan Zapp with us, Crossing the Event Horizon. One of the things you've done in the book, Crossing the Event Horizon, you key in on the psychopath, Jonathan, and tell me that connection to this first and foremost.
Okay, and it may tie in better when we get to the full context of the singularity archetype, but we talked earlier about competing evolutionary streams. So, for example, we have technology, which maybe a catalyst for organic evolution in certain ways, rewiring the brain, but it can also be an antagonist to human evolution because we also poison ourselves and so forth. And AI itself may become a competing evolutionary possibility. But psychopaths are considered by evolutionary biologists to be a subspecies. At least many evolutionary biologists believe that. There are genetic differences. They also have observable differences in brain scans, and particularly functional MRI scans show that they fundamentally respond to, or their emotions are fundamentally different than average. They have proto-emotions rather than the full range of emotions. But these evolutionary biologists also say that they are best understood as a very successful and very well-adapted subspecies. Psychopathy is not considered a mental illness. It does not make people delusional. They tend to actually be more coldly rational than average. Psychopaths are about 1% of the population. They're more male than female. And unfortunately, they are also better at spreading their genes than the average male. They are more likely to impregnate women because they tend to be very charismatic. Women may respond to them as alpha males. Mm-hmm. And they also are very good at abandoning partners, which gives them a chance to then impregnate somebody else.
So, do they know, Jonathan, that they're psychopaths?
Well, they may understand how they're different than other people. They recognize that other people have what they would consider foibles or emotions that they just see as weaknesses that they don't have. But this will vary from individual to individual. Some may actually know their diagnosis, and others are just sort of doing their thing without ever taking the time to reflect on it. And so with the singularity archetype, one of the themes that is very powerful and plays out in different ways is what I call the mutant versus the machine. What will happen that will become a wild card in human evolution is you get a mutant. You get somebody who breaks the mold in some way. And maybe they may have paranormal powers. They may have incredible charisma. And they may threaten the military-industrial complex. They may threaten the whole order.
That may be a good thing.
Well, so that's the thing. Because we just had, for example, Edward Snowden. Brian Williams did the first national TV interview with him. It was just before we came on. And so here's an example of somebody who doesn't have paranormal powers, but in a sense he does, by being very clever and by the fact that technology cuts both ways. It can give the government more power, but it can also give an individual more power because an individual that is clever enough to know how to wield the technology can walk away with, 1.7 million documents, as some claim that he has. And he's caused huge change worldwide and huge change in this country with new legislation passed and effects on the Obama presidency and just profound effects. So basically, the mutants could be good or they could be evil, but they are a disruptor. They punctuate the equilibrium. And so Edward Snowden is an example of an individual who is able to, even though they're a single individual, and even though so many things in our society seem to make the single individual insignificant, there's this other thing where the very unusual individual can come in and shift everything. Now, the way it plays out in many of the greatest visions of the singularity archetype, which often turn out to be science fiction stories, you have, for example, in the great science fiction classic Dune by Frank Herbert, which was also made into a movie, and there were many other subsequent books. But you have one 15-year-old boy who's a member of a royal family, but who is part of a genetic breeding program to create a very powerful mutant called the Kwisatz Haderach. And he also takes a certain psychoactive substance called spice, and he starts to have prescience. He starts to have visions where he can see how different actions that he takes, what chain of events they will set up. And because of this enhanced vision that he has, he's able to throw over an entire galactic empire, an entire galactic military-industrial complex, basically. And this plays out in so many of these different visions, like in the greatest Japanese anime movie ever made, Akira. You have a few mutants who are incredibly powerful and who threaten the whole military-industrial complex, and Akira is one of them. And he is so powerful that even though he's been destroyed and they have a few of his cells, they have to keep those cells like several sub-basements down below the Japanese equivalent of the Pentagon in a vault at absolute zero, because if even a single one reanimates, it threatens the whole military-industrial complex. And so if you just sort of take that metaphorically and you think about it sort of being down there in the unconscious, down in the vault, and even a single cell could act as a seed crystal to change everything. So this is a key part of the singularity archetype, and it means that mutant or mutants, some of them could be empaths and be unusually loving. Maybe Jesus was such a one. I mean, consider that Jesus was one individual, and yet the changes that he wrought have rippled through time ever since he was alive. But it could also be somebody diabolical, like a Hitler, who had many paranormal experiences and began reading books in the occult bookstore and having visions. And
what about the devil?
Well, the devil is an archetype, and the devil, can be seen as a in a theological way or on a cosmic plane as another example of that mutant versus the established order, because in at least the Christian version of the devil, he is one of the highest of the angels. So in other words, he's a highly evolved being with all kinds of special powers, but because he has been set in a role, and it seems as if in some way God has wanted him to play this role. Just like in the book of Job, God allows him to test Job. So if we think about that in terms of the singularity archetype, these mutants, even the very disruptive ones who may be on the dark side, who might be psychopaths, may serve a valuable evolutionary purpose, because in order to get evolution, you have to break up an equilibrium. That's why they call it punctuated equilibrium, like when a giant asteroid apparently hit the Earth 65 million years ago. Well, that broke up the equilibrium where dinosaurs ruled, and that was the opportunity for mammals to come in. So sometimes you need a very destructive event to create a quantum evolutionary change.
Would you consider, though, psychopaths created, or were they always there? You know, something genetic, for example.
Well, psychopaths, there is a genetic aspect. It's a fairly strong correlation when they've done identical twin studies with identical twins reared separately. If one is a psychopath, it's more probable than the other one will be. It's equivalent to the genetic correlation for schizophrenia with identical twin studies. And they have always been there. And so, for example, there was an ancient Greek or Roman author who wrote a text called The Man Without Conscience, where he just very accurately describes what psychopaths are like. In Inuit culture, they had a name for a psychopath called the Kunlagenta. So many cultures have recognized that this type has always been there. And what some evolutionary biologists theorize is that in hunter-gatherer societies, you wanted a warrior type. You wanted someone who was not inhibited by emotions and conscience, who would be the guy leading the charge with the spear. And so psychopaths can play useful roles in society. They're not always doing bad things. For example, I would be glad to have a psychopathic surgeon. You know, if you had a choice, George, between you're going in for a big operation and you could have an empathic surgeon who really cares about you but is going to get really stressed out if things start to go south during the operation, and another highly respected surgeon who just happens to be a psychopath, but he is cold as ice. He loves risk. He loves challenge. And his heart rate isn't even going to go up if there's a crisis during the surgery.
Well, but how do you know that psychopathic surgeon, Jonathan, isn't going to put a pig's valve on your nose and think it's funny? as opposed to the other guy who, you know, may really try to do what he can do for you?
Well, because psychopaths tend to be highly rational. They're not just given to, like, random chaotic impulses. So in other words, if you had a psychopathic surgeon who took a lot of pride in his reputation, he's making a good living at this, like, he wants to have successful surgeries. Now, maybe if he had some reason if you were, you know, cheating with his wife or something, he might not hesitate to, like, you know, make sure you didn't come out of the operation or something
like that. Like the dentist a week ago who took out all the teeth of the woman who died. You know, she just suffocated in her own gurgle. I mean, are psychopaths mean and dangerous, or are they something else, or a combination of both?
Well, so the thing is, tremendous variability. It's just like if we look at non-psychopaths, some non-psychopaths are great people, and some non-psychopaths are terrible people. So in other words, not all non-psychopaths are good, and not all psychopaths are violent maniacs. So where there's the greatest chance to study psychopaths are in prisons, because these are like the lowest functioning psychopaths, and there's a much higher percentage of psychopaths amongst violent offenders and wife abusers and so forth.
They're the ones that got caught.
Exactly. But the high functioning psychopaths are the people running Wall Street. And the group that tests out with the highest percentage of any occupational group with the highest percentage of psychopathy are CEOs.
And most are geniuses, aren't they?
Well, I mean, CEOs might be very, very bright individuals. So psychopaths are test out with higher IQs than average, but it doesn't mean that they're all brilliant. You know, certainly not. But you can certainly have a brilliant psychopath, and they have a lot of advantages in the modern business world, and that's why some evolutionary biologists call them the man of the future, because they're charismatic, they're decisive, they don't crack under pressure, and so forth. But there is a flaw in there are many flaws in the way they do things that have posed a grave threat to society and perhaps throughout history. And I wrote about some of this in a document. It's on my website, or it's also a podcast called Foxes and Reptiles, Psychopathy and the Financial Meltdown. And the culture, what I call the culture of psychopathy, really rules on Wall Street and in high finance, where there is this cold-blooded ruthlessness, where there's absolutely no empathy for how actions are going to affect others. They're just interested in the short-term reward. And I think that the last financial meltdown was directly the result of psychopathy.
And greed.
Yeah, right. Well, that's part of it. But, you know, Alan Greenspan was the one that really tipped me off to this because he gave some kind of sort of mea culpa testimony before Congress. And he said basically in Alan Greenspanese, and I'm going to make it a little bit more like English, that he recognized a flaw in his model, that he assumed that self-interest would keep people from doing certain things. He basically said there was a psychological flaw in his economic model. And what I think the flaw is that high finance tends to be ruled by psychopaths and the culture of psychopathy, and there is one area where psychopaths are not always rational, and that is that they love risk. They love pushing the limits because since they don't have the usual range of emotions, they want to do risky stuff to get an adrenaline buzz. And so that is a lot of what melted down the economy, is that you had people that were not even acting in the interests of their own company or even in their own ultimate interests, but just couldn't resist pushing the limit when that greed pushed them towards some short-term profit. They couldn't help but to go for it. And so that's a big flaw in our system. And we see the culture of psychopathy in the way many governments relate and the way that they will often be ruthless to their own populations. Psychopaths have often pushed themselves right into the center of power.
Would you call Bernie Madoff a psychopath or a sociopath?
Well, many people think that he's a psychopath. I mean, it's a dangerous game to try and diagnose people from a distance, but I do mention him in my piece on psychopathy because people who interviewed him described him as just cool as a cucumber. When people from the SEC were questioning him and asking him questions, you know, if you or I are an ordinary person, were Bernie Madoff and knew like this, you know, fragile Ponzi scheme we're sitting on, and the guys from the SEC were asking about it, you know, we'd be sweating bullets. Psychopath, their heart rate doesn't even go up. They're completely comfortable lying. And so they handle risky situations really well. They can even pass lie detector tests. So,
well, that's pretty good if they can do that, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, they're very well adapted to succeed in the modern world. And so they may be, you know, there was a James Joyce character, Stephen Dedalus, who said, history is the nightmare from which I'm trying to awaken. Well, psychopaths may be a big part of that nightmare. And what we're discovering is that the good news is we're waking up to who they are. There's been an explosion of popular interest and recognition that all of our lives are affected by it. Everybody's going to be affected personally because 1 in 100 people are psychopaths, so eventually we're going to have a personal run-in with one. But these people have also changed the economy and run large parts of the world. And so they are, so often what looks like a global conspiracy, and I'm not saying that there aren't conspiracies, there are, but sometimes it looks like that because psychopaths in one place tend to act with the same modus operandi as psychopaths in another place. And it can look like they're all part of the same group, but they're actually just acting in similar ways because they're all psychopaths. So apocalypse means unveiling. And so I think that part of the positive side of apocalypse that's going on right now is that people are waking up to that we've had these predators in our midst all along. And so one of the interesting things during the financial meltdown that relates to psychopathy is there was all this talk about the 99% and the 1%. Now, what's interesting is that turns out to be a wrong ratio because the real elite are like 1/100th or 1/1000th of a percent. However,
but so powerful. So powerful.
Right,
hold
so
on,
powerful.
Jonathan. We're going to take this break, and we're going to come back with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Fast night. We'll be back.